Looking for Alaska by John Green. To my family, Sydney Green, Mike Green, and Hank Green, I have tried so hard to do right. Last words of President Grover Cleveland. Before. 136 days before. The week before I left my family and Florida and the rest of my minor life to go to boarding school in Alabama, my mother insisted on throwing me a going-away party. To say that I had low expectations would be to underestimate the matter dramatically. Although I was more or less forced to invite all my school friends, i.e. the ragtag bunch of drama people and English geeks I sat with by social necessity in the cavernous cafeteria of my public school, I knew they wouldn't come. Still, my mother persevered, awash in the delusion that I had kept my popularity secret from her all these years. She cooked a small mountain of artichoke dip. She festooned our living room in green and yellow streamers, the colors of my new school. She bought 2 dozen champagne poppers and placed them around the edge of our coffee table. And when that final Friday came, when my packing was mostly done, she sat with my dad and me on the living room couch at 4:56 p.m., and patiently awaited the arrival of the Goodbye to Miles cavalry. Said cavalry consisted of exactly 2 people, Marie Lawson, a tiny blonde with rectangular glasses, and her chunky, to put it charitably, boyfriend, Will.
"Hey, Miles," Marie said as she sat down.
"Hey," I said.
"How was your summer?" Will asked.
"Okay. Yours?"
"Good. We did Jesus Christ Superstar. I helped with the sets. Marie did lights," said Will.
"That's cool." I nodded knowingly, and that about exhausted our conversational topics. I might have asked a question about Jesus Christ Superstar, except that, 1, I didn't know what it was, and 2, I didn't care to learn, and 3, I never really excelled at small talk. My mom, however, can talk small for hours. And so she extended the awkwardness by asking them about their rehearsal schedule and how the show had gone and whether it was a success.
"I guess it was," Marie said. "A lot of people came, I guess."
Marie was the sort of person to guess a lot. Finally, Will said, "Well, we just dropped by to say goodbye. I've got to get Marie home by 6. Have fun at boarding school, Miles." "Thanks," I answered, relieved. The only thing worse than having a party that no one attends is having a party attended only by 2 vastly, deeply uninteresting people. They left, and so I sat with my parents and stared at the blank TV and wanted to turn it on but knew I shouldn't. I could feel them both looking at me, waiting for me to burst into tears or something, as if I hadn't known all along that it would go precisely like this. But I had known. I could feel their pity as they scooped artichoke dip with chips intended for my imaginary friends, but they needed pity more than I did. I wasn't disappointed. My expectations had been met.
"Is this why you want to leave, Miles?" Mom asked.
I mulled it over for a moment, careful not to look at her. No, I said.
"Well, then why?" she asked.
This was not the first time she had posed the question. Mom was not particularly keen on letting me go to boarding school and had made no secret of it.
"Because of me?" my dad asked.
He had attended Culver Creek, the same boarding school to which I was headed, as had both of his brothers and all of their kids. I think he liked the idea of me following in his footsteps. My uncles had told me stories about how famous my dad had been on campus, for having simultaneously raised hell and aced all his classes. That sounded like a better life than the one I had in Florida. But no, it wasn't because of Dad. Not exactly. "Hold on," I said. I went into Dad's study and found his biography of Francois Rabelais. I liked reading biographies of writers, even if, as was the case with Monsieur Rabelais, I'd never read any of their actual writing. I flipped to the back and found the highlighted quote. "Never use a highlighter in my books," my dad had told me 1,000 times, "but how else are you supposed to find what you're looking for?" "So this guy," I said, standing in the doorway of the living room, "Francois Rabelais, he was this poet, and his last words were, 'I go to seek a great perhaps.' That's why I'm going, so I don't have to wait until I die to start seeking a great perhaps." And that quieted them. I was after a great perhaps, and they knew as well as I did that I wasn't going to find it with the likes of Will and Marie. I sat back down on the couch between my mom and my dad put his arm around me, and we stayed there like that, quiet on the couch together for a long time, until it seemed okay to turn on the TV. And then we ate artichoke dip for dinner and watched the History Channel. And as going-away parties go, it certainly could have been worse. 128 days before. Florida was plenty hot, certainly, and humid, too. Hot enough that your clothes stuck to you like scotch tape, and sweat dripped like tears from your forehead into your eyes. But it was only hot outside, and generally I only went outside to walk from one air-conditioned location to another. This did not prepare me for the unique sort of heat that one encounters 15 miles south of Birmingham, Alabama, at Culver Creek Preparatory School. My parents' SUV was parked in the grass just a few feet outside my dorm room, room 43. But each time I took those few steps to and from the car to unload what now seemed like far too much stuff, the sun burned through my clothes and into my skin with a vicious ferocity that made me genuinely fear hellfire. Between Mom and Dad and me, it only took a few minutes to unload the car, but my un-air-conditioned dorm room, although blessedly out of the sunshine, was only modestly cooler. The room surprised me. I'd pictured plush carpet, wood-paneled walls, Victorian furniture. Aside from one luxury, a private bathroom, I got a box, with cinder-block walls coated thick with layers of white paint, and a green-and-white checkered linoleum floor. The place looked more like a hospital than the dorm room of my fantasies. A bunk bed of unfinished wood with vinyl mattresses was pushed against the room's back window. The desks and dressers and bookshelves were all attached to the walls in order to prevent creative floor planning. And no air conditioning. I sat on the lower bunk while Mom opened the trunk, grabbed a stack of the biographies my dad had agreed to part with, and placed them on the bookshelves. "I can unpack, Mom," I said. My dad stood. He was ready to go.
"Let me at least make your bed," Mom said.
"No, really, I can do it. It's okay. Because you simply cannot draw these things out forever. At some point, you just pull off the Band-Aid and it hurts, but then it's over and you're relieved."
"God will miss you," Mom said suddenly, stepping through the minefield of suitcases to get to the bed.
I stood and hugged her. My dad walked over too, and we formed a sort of huddle. It was too hot, and we were too sweaty for the hug to last terribly long. I knew I ought to cry, but I'd lived with my parents for 16 years, and a trial separation seemed overdue.
"Don't worry," I smiled.
"I's a-gonna learn how to talk right Southern."
Mom laughed. "Don't do anything stupid," my dad said.
"Okay."
"No drugs, no drinking, no cigarettes."
As an alumnus of Culver Creek, he had done the things I had only heard about, the secret parties, streaking through hay fields. He always whined about how it was all boys back then, drugs, drinking, and cigarettes. It had taken him a while to kick smoking, but his badass days were now well behind him.
"I love you," they both blurted out simultaneously.
It needed to be said, but the words made the whole thing horribly uncomfortable, like watching your grandparents kiss.
"I love you too. I'll call every Sunday." Our rooms had no phone lines, but my parents had requested I be placed in a room near one of Culver Creek's 5 payphones. They hugged me again, Mom, then Dad, and it was over. Out the back window, I watched them drive the winding road off campus. I should have felt a gooey sentimental sadness, perhaps, but mostly I just wanted to cool off. So I grabbed one of the desk chairs and sat down outside my door in the shade of the overhanging eaves, waiting for a breeze that never arrived. The air outside sat as still and oppressive as the air inside. I stared out over my new digs. 6 one-story buildings, each with 16 dorm rooms, were arranged in a hexagram around a large circle of grass. It looked like an oversized old motel. Everywhere, boys and girls hugged and smiled and walked together. I vaguely hoped that someone would come up and talk to me. I imagined the conversation.
"Hey, is this your first year?"
"Yeah, I'm from Florida."
"That's cool, so you're used to the heat." I wouldn't be used to this heat if I were from Hades, I'd joke. I'd make a good first impression. Oh, he's funny. That guy Miles is a riot. That didn't happen, of course. Things never happened like I imagined them. Bored, I went back inside, took off my shirt, laid down on the heat-soaked vinyl of the lower bunk mattress, and closed my eyes. I'd never been born again, with the baptism and weeping and all that, but it couldn't feel much better than being born again as a guy with no known past. I thought of the people I'd read about, John F. Kennedy, James Joyce, Humphrey Bogart, who went to boarding school, and their adventures. Kennedy, for example, loved pranks. I thought of the great perhaps, and the things that might happen, and the people I might meet, and who my roommate might be. I'd gotten a letter a few weeks before that gave me his name, Chip Martin, but no other information. Whoever Chip Martin was, I hoped to God he would bring an arsenal of high-powered fans, because I hadn't packed even one, and I could already feel my sweat pooling on the vinyl mattress, which disgusted me so much that I stopped thinking and got off my ass to find a towel to wipe up the sweat with. And then I thought, well, before the adventure comes the unpacking. I managed to tape a map of the world to the wall and get most of my clothes into drawers before I noticed that the hot, moist air made even the walls sweat, and I decided that now was not the time for manual labor. Now was the time for a magnificently cold shower. The small bathroom contained a huge, full-length mirror behind the door, and so I could not escape the reflection of my naked self as I leaned in to turn on the shower faucet. My skinniness always surprised me. My thin arms didn't seem to get much bigger as they moved from wrist to shoulder. My chest lacked any hint of either fat or muscle, and I felt embarrassed and wondered if something could be done about the mirror. I pulled open the plain white shower curtain and ducked into the stall. Unfortunately, the shower seemed to have been designed for someone approximately 3 feet 7 inches tall, so the cold water hit my lower rib cage with all the force of a dripping faucet. To wet my sweat-soaked face, I had to spread my legs and squat significantly. Surely, John F. Kennedy, who was 6 feet tall according to his biography, my height exactly, did not have to squat at his boarding school. No, this was a different beast entirely, and as the dribbling shower slowly soaked my body, I wondered whether I could find a great perhaps here at all, or whether I had made a grand miscalculation. When I opened the bathroom door after my shower, a towel wrapped around my waist, I saw a short, muscular guy with a shock of brown hair. He was hauling a gigantic army green duffel bag through the door of my room. He stood 5 feet and nothing, but was well-built, like a scale model of Adonis. And with him arrived the stink of stale cigarette smoke. Great, I thought, I'm meeting my roommate naked. He heaved the duffel into the room, closed the door, and walked over to me.
I'm Chip Martin, he announced in a deep voice, the voice of a radio DJ.
Before I could respond, he added, I'd shake your hand, but I think you should hold on damn tight to that towel till you can get some clothes on. I laughed and nodded my head at him. That's cool, right, the nod? And said, I'm Miles Halter. Nice to meet you.
Miles, as in to go before I sleep? He asked me.
Huh?
It's a Robert Frost poem. You've never read him?
I shook my head no.
Consider yourself lucky.
He smiled. I grabbed some clean underwear, a pair of blue Adidas soccer shorts, and a white T-shirt, mumbled that I'd be back in a second, and ducked back into the bathroom. So much for a good first impression.
So where are your parents? I asked from the bathroom.
My parents? The father's in California right now, maybe sitting in his Lazy Boy, maybe driving his truck. Either way, he's drinking. My mother is probably just now turning off campus.
Oh, I said, dressed now, not sure how to respond to such personal information. I shouldn't have asked, I guess, if I didn't want to know.
Chip grabbed some sheets and tossed them onto the top bunk. I'm a top bunk man. Hope that doesn't bother you.
No, whatever is fine.
I see you've decorated the place, he said, gesturing toward the world map. I like it.
And then he started naming countries. He spoke in a monotone, as if he'd done it 1,000 times before.
Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria, American Samoa, Andorra,
and so on.
He got through the A's before looking up and noticing my incredulous stare.
I could do the rest, but it'd probably bore you. Something I learned over the summer. God, you can't imagine how boring New Hope, Alabama is in the summertime. Like watching soybeans grow. Where are you from, by the way?
Florida, I said.
Never been.
That's pretty amazing, the country's thing, I said.
Yeah, everybody's got a talent. I can memorize things.
And you can... I know a lot of people's last words. It was an indulgence, learning last words. Other people had chocolate. I had dying declarations.
Example?
I like Henrik Ibsen's. He was a playwright. I knew a lot about Ibsen, but I'd never read any of his plays. I don't like reading plays. I liked reading biographies.
Yeah, I know who he was, said Chip.
Right, well, he'd been sick for a while, and his nurse said to him, "You seem to be feeling better this morning." And Ibsen looked at her and said, "On the contrary." And then he died.
Chip laughed. That's morbid, but I like it.
He told me he was in his third year at Culver Creek. He had started in ninth grade, the first year at the school, and was now a junior, like me. A scholarship kid, he said, got a full ride. He'd heard it was the best school in Alabama, so he wrote his application essay about how he wanted to go to a school where he could read long books. The problem, he said in the essay, was that his dad would always hit him with the books in his house, so Chip kept his books short and paperback for his own safety. His parents got divorced his sophomore year. He liked the creek, as he called it, but
you have to be careful here, with students and with teachers. And I do hate being careful.
He smirked. I hated being careful, too, or wanted to, at least. He told me this while ripping through his duffel bag, throwing clothes into drawers with reckless abandon. Chip did not believe in having a sock drawer or a t-shirt drawer. He believed that all drawers were created equal and filled each with whatever fit. My mother would have died. As soon as he finished unpacking, Chip hit me roughly on the shoulder, said,
"I hope you're stronger than you look,"
and walked out the door, leaving it open behind him. He peeked his head back in a few seconds later and saw me standing still.
"Well, come on, Miles to Go Halter. We've got shit to do."
We made our way to the TV room, which, according to Chip, contained the only cable TV on campus. Over the summer, it served as a storage unit. Packed nearly to the ceiling with couches, fridges, and rolled-up carpets, the TV room undulated with kids trying to find and haul away their stuff. Chip said hello to a few people, but didn't introduce me. As he wandered through the couch-stocked maze, I stood near the room's entrance, trying my best not to block pairs of roommates as they maneuvered furniture through the narrow front door. It took 10 minutes for Chip to find his stuff, and an hour more for us to make 4 trips back and forth across the dorm circle between the TV room and room 43. By the end, I wanted to crawl into Chip's mini-fridge and sleep for 1,000 years, but Chip seemed immune to both fatigue and heatstroke. I sat down on his couch.
"I found it lying on a curb in my neighborhood a couple years ago," he said of the couch as he worked on setting up my PlayStation 2 on top of his footlocker. "I know the leather's got some cracks, but come on, that's a damn nice couch."
The leather had more than a few cracks. It was about 30% baby blue faux leather and 70% foam, but it felt damn good to me anyway.
"All right," he said. "We're about done."
He walked over to his desk and pulled a roll of duct tape from a drawer.
"We just need your trunk."
I got up, pulled the trunk out from under the bed, and Chip situated it between the couch and the PlayStation 2 and started tearing off thin strips of duct tape. He applied them to the trunk so that they spelled out coffee table.
"There," he said.
He sat down and put his feet up on the, coffee table.
"Done."
I sat down next to him, and he looked over at me and suddenly said,
"Listen, I'm not going to be your entree to Culver Creek social life."
Okay, I said, but I could hear the words catch in my throat. I'd just carried this guy's couch beneath a white-hot sun, and now he didn't like me?
"Basically, you've got 2 groups here," he explained, speaking with increasing urgency. You've got the regular boarders, like me, and then you've got the weekday warriors. They board here, but they're all rich kids who live in Birmingham and go home to their parents' air-conditioned mansions every weekend. Those are the cool kids. I don't like them, and they don't like me. So if you came here thinking that you were hot shit at public school so you'll be hot shit here, you'd best not be seen with me. You did go to public school, didn't you? I said. Absent-mindedly, I began picking at the cracks in the couch's leather, digging my fingers into the foamy whiteness. Right, you did. Probably because if you had gone to a private school, your freaking shorts would fit. He laughed. I wore my shorts just below my hips, which I thought was cool. Finally, I said, yeah, I went to public school, but I wasn't hot shit there, Chip. I was regular shit. Ha, that's good. And don't call me Chip. Call me the Colonel. I stifled a laugh. The Colonel? Yeah, the Colonel. And we'll call you, Pudge. Huh? Pudge, the Colonel said. Because you're skinny. It's called irony, Pudge. Heard of it? Now, let's go get some cigarettes and start this year off right. He walked out of the room, again just assuming I'd follow, and this time I did. Mercifully, the sun was descending toward the horizon. We walked 5 doors down to room 48. A dry erase board was taped to the door using duct tape. In blue marker, it read, Alaska has a single. The Colonel explained to me that, one, this was Alaska's room, and that, two, she had a single room because the girl who was supposed to be her roommate got kicked out at the end of last year, and that, three, Alaska had cigarettes, although the Colonel neglected to ask whether, four, I smoked, which, five, I didn't. He knocked once, loudly. Through the door, a voice screamed, Oh, my God, come in, you short little man, because I have the best story. We walked in. I turned to close the door behind me, and the Colonel shook his head and said, After 7, you have to leave the door open if you're in a girl's room. But I barely heard him, because the hottest girl in all of human history was standing before me in cut-off jeans and a peach tank top. And she was talking over the Colonel, talking loud and fast. So, first day of summer, I'm in Grand Old Vine Station with this boy named Justin, and we're at his house watching TV on the couch. And mind you, I'm already dating Jake. Actually, I'm still dating him, miraculously enough. But Justin is a friend of mine from when I was a kid. And so we're watching TV and literally chatting about the SATs or something. And Justin puts his arm around me, and I think, oh, that's nice. We've been friends for so long, and this is totally comfortable. And we're just chatting, and then I'm in the middle of a sentence about analogies or something, and like a hawk, he reaches down and he honks my boob. Honk. A much too firm 2 to 3 second honk. And the first thing I thought was, okay, how do I extricate this claw from my boob before it leaves permanent marks? And the second thing I thought was, God, I can't wait to tell Takumi and the Colonel. The Colonel laughed. I stared, stunned partly by the force of the voice emanating from the petite but, God, curvy girl, and partly by the gigantic stacks of books that lined her walls. Her library filled her bookshelves and then overflowed into waist-high stacks of books everywhere, piled haphazardly against the walls. If just one of them moved, I thought, the domino effect could engulf the three of us in an asphyxiating mass of literature. "Who's the guy that's not laughing at my very funny story?" she asked. "Oh, right. Alaska, this is Pudge. Pudge memorizes people's last words. Pudge, this is Alaska. She got her boob honked over the summer."
She walked over to me with her hand extended, then made a quick move downward at the last moment and pulled down my shorts.
"Those are the biggest shorts in the state of Alabama."
"I like them baggy," I said, embarrassed, and pulled them up. They had been cool back home in Florida.
"So far in our relationship, Pudge, I've seen your chicken legs entirely too often," the Colonel deadpanned. "So, Alaska, sell us some cigarettes?"
And then, somehow, the Colonel talked me into paying $5 for a pack of Marlboro Lights I had no intention of ever smoking. He asked Alaska to join us, but she said, "I have to find Takumi and tell him about the honk." She turned to me and asked, "Have you seen him?" I had no idea whether I'd seen Takumi, since I had no idea who he was.
I just shook my head. All right, meet you at the lake in a few minutes then.
The colonel nodded. At the edge of the lake, just before the sandy and, the colonel told me, fake beach, we sat down in an Adirondack swing. I made the obligatory joke. Don't grab my boob. The colonel gave an obligatory laugh, then asked, want to smoke? I had never smoked a cigarette, but when in Rome. Is it safe here? Not really, he said, then lit a cigarette and handed it to me. I inhaled, coughed, wheezed, gasped for breath, coughed again, considered vomiting, grabbed the swinging bench, head spinning, and threw the cigarette to the ground and stomped on it, convinced my great perhaps did not involve cigarettes. Smoke much? He laughed, then pointed to a white speck across the lake and said, see that? Yeah, I said, what is that, a bird? It's the swan, he said. Wow, a school with a swan, wow. That swan is the spawn of Satan. Never get closer to it than we are now. Why? It has some issues with people. It was abused or something. It'll rip you to pieces. The eagle put it there to keep us from walking around the lake to smoke. The eagle? Mr. Starnes. Codename, the eagle. The dean of students. Most of the teachers live on campus, and they'll all bust you. But only the eagle lives in the dorm circle, and he sees all. He can smell a cigarette from, like, 5 miles.
Isn't his house back there? I asked, pointing to it. I could see the house quite clearly, despite the darkness, so it followed he could probably see us.
Yeah, but he doesn't really go into blitzkrieg mode until classes start, Chip said nonchalantly.
God, if I get in trouble, my parents will kill me, I said.
I suspect you're exaggerating. But look, you're going to get in trouble. 99% of the time, your parents never have to know, though. The school doesn't want your parents to think you became a fuck-up here any more than you want your parents to think you're a fuck-up.
He blew a thin stream of smoke forcefully toward the lake. I had to admit, he looked cool doing it. Taller, somehow.
Anyway, when you get into trouble, just don't tell on anyone. I mean, I hate the rich snots here with a fervent passion I usually reserve only for dental work and my father, but that doesn't mean I would rat them out. Pretty much the only important thing is never, 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 never rat.
Okay, I said, although I wondered, if someone punches me in the face, I'm supposed to insist that I ran into a door? It seemed a little stupid. How do you deal with bullies and assholes if you can't get them into trouble? I didn't ask Chip, though.
All right, Pudge. We have reached the point in the evening when I'm obliged to go and find my girlfriend. So give me a few of those cigarettes you'll never smoke anyway, and I'll see you later.
I decided to hang out on the swing for a while, half because the heat had finally dissipated into a pleasant, if muggy, 80-something, and half because I thought Alaska might show up. But almost as soon as the colonel left, the bugs encroached. No see-ems, which, for the record, you can see, and mosquitoes hovered around me in such numbers that the tiny noise of their rubbing wings sounded cacophonous. And then I decided to smoke. Now, I did think the smoke will drive the bugs away, and to some degree it did. I'd be lying, though, if I claimed I became a smoker to ward off insects. I became a smoker because, one, I was on an Adirondack swing by myself, and, two, I had cigarettes, and, three, I figured that if everyone else could smoke a cigarette without coughing, I could damn well, too. In short, I didn't have a very good reason. So, yeah, let's just say that, four, it was the bugs. I made it through 3 entire drags before I felt nauseous and dizzy and only semi-pleasantly buzzed. I got up to leave. As I stood, a voice behind me said, "So do you really memorize last words?" She ran up beside me and grabbed my shoulder and pushed me back onto the porch swing. "Yeah," I said, and then, hesitantly, I added, "You want to quiz me?"
"JFK," she said.
"That's obvious," I answered.
"Oh, is it now?" she asked.
"No, those were his last words. Someone said, 'Mr. President, you can't say Dallas doesn't love you.' And then he said, 'That's obvious,' and then he got shot."
She laughed.
God, that's awful. I shouldn't laugh, but I will.
And then she laughed again.
Okay, Mr. Famous Last Words Boy, I have one for you.
She reached into her overstuffed backpack and pulled out a book.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez, The General in His Labyrinth, absolutely one of my favorites. It's about Simone Bolivar.
I didn't know who Simone Bolivar was, but she didn't give me time to ask.
It's a historical novel, so I don't know if this is true, but in the book, do you know what his last words are?
No, you don't. But I am about to tell you, Senor Parting Remarks. And then she lit a cigarette and sucked on it so hard for so long that I thought the entire thing might burn off in one drag.
She exhaled and read to me. He, that's Simon Bolivar, was shaken by the overwhelming revelation that the headlong race between his misfortunes and his dreams was at that moment reaching the finish line. The rest was darkness. Damn it, he sighed. How will I ever get out of this labyrinth?
I knew great last words when I heard them, and I made a mental note to get a hold of a biography of this Simon Bolivar fellow.
Beautiful last words, but I didn't quite understand. So, what's the labyrinth? I asked her.
And now is as good a time as any to say that she was beautiful. In the dark, beside me, she smelled of sweat and sunshine and vanilla, and on that thin mooned night, I could see little more than her silhouette, except for when she smoked, when the burning cherry of the cigarette washed her face in pale red light. But even in the dark, I could see her eyes, fierce emeralds. She had the kind of eyes that predisposed you to supporting her every endeavor. And not just beautiful, but hot, too, with her breasts straining against her tight tank top, her curved legs swinging back and forth beneath the swing, flip-flops dangling from her electric blue-painted toes. It was right then, between when I asked about the labyrinth and when she answered me, that I realized the importance of curves, of the thousand places where girls' bodies ease from one place to another, from arc of the foot to ankle to calf, from calf to hip to waist to breast to neck to ski-slope nose to forehead to shoulder to the concave arch of the back to the butt to the etc. I'd noticed curves before, of course, but I had never quite apprehended their significance. Her mouth close enough to me that I could feel her breath warmer than the air, she said, "That's the mystery, isn't it? Is the labyrinth living or dying? Which is he trying to escape, the world or the end of it?" I waited for her to keep talking, but after a while, it became obvious she wanted an answer. I don't know, I said finally. Have you really read all those books in your room? She laughed. Oh, God, no. I've maybe read a third of them. But I'm going to read them all. I call it my life's library. Every summer, since I was little, I've gone to garage sales and bought all the books that looked interesting, so I always have something to read. But there's so much to do. Cigarettes to smoke, sex to have, swings to swing on. I'll have more time for reading when I'm old and boring. She told me that I reminded her of the Colonel when he came to Culver Creek. They were freshmen together, she said, both scholarship kids with, as she put it, a shared interest in booze and mischief. The phrase booze and mischief left me worrying I'd stumbled into what my mother referred to as the wrong crowd. But for the wrong crowd, they both seemed awfully smart. As she lit a new cigarette off the butt of her previous one, she told me that the Colonel was smart, but hadn't done much living when he got to the creek. I got rid of that problem quickly. She smiled. By November, I'd gotten him his first girlfriend, a perfectly nice, non-weekday warrior named Janice. He dumped her after a month because she was too rich for his poverty-soaked blood, but whatever. We pulled our first prank that year. We filled Classroom 4 with a thin layer of marbles. We've progressed some since then, of course. She laughed. So Chip became the colonel, the military-style planner of their pranks, and Alaska was ever Alaska, the larger-than-life creative force behind them.
You're smart, like him, she said. Quieter, though.
And cuter, but I didn't even just say that because I love my boyfriend. Yeah, you're not bad either, I said, overwhelmed by her compliment. But I didn't just say that because I love my girlfriend.
Oh, wait, right. I don't have one. She laughed.
Yeah? Don't worry, Pudge. If there's one thing I can get you, it's a girlfriend. Let's make a deal. You figure out what the labyrinth is and how to get out of it, and I'll get you laid.
Deal. We shook on it. Later, I walked toward the dorm circle beside Alaska. The cicadas hummed their one-note song just as they had at home in Florida. She turned to me as we made our way through the darkness and said,
"When you're walking at night, do you ever get creeped out, and even though it's silly and embarrassing, you just want to run home?"
It seemed too secret and personal to admit to a virtual stranger, but I told her, "Yeah, totally." For a moment, she was quiet. Then she grabbed my hand, whispered, "Run, run, 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 run," and took off, pulling me behind her. 127 days before. Early the next afternoon, I blinked sweat from my eyes as I taped a Van Gogh poster to the back of the door. The colonel sat on the couch, judging whether the poster was level and fielding my endless questions about Alaska.
"What's her story?"
"She's from Vine Station. You could drive past it without noticing, and from what I understand, you ought to. Her boyfriend's at Vanderbilt on scholarship, plays bass in some band. Don't know much about her family."
"So she really likes him?"
"I guess. She hasn't cheated on him, which is a first." And so on. All morning, I'd been unable to care about anything else. Not the Van Gogh poster, and not video games, and not even my class schedule, which the Eagle had brought by that morning. He introduced himself, too. "Welcome to Culver Creek, Mr. Halter. You're given a large measure of freedom here. If you abuse it, you'll regret it. You seem like a nice young man. I'd hate to have to bid you farewell." And then he stared at me in a manner that was either serious or seriously malicious.
"Alaska calls that the look of doom," the colonel told me after the Eagle left. "The next time you see that, you're busted."
"Okay, Pudge," the colonel said as I stepped away from the poster, not entirely level, but close enough.
"Enough with the Alaska already. By my count, there are 92 girls at this school, and every last one of them is less crazy than Alaska, who, I might add, already has a boyfriend. I'm going to lunch. It's Bufrido Day."
He walked out, leaving the door open. Feeling like an over-infatuated idiot, I got up to close the door. The colonel, already halfway across the dorm circle, turned around.
"Christ, are you coming or what?"
You can say a lot of bad things about Alabama, but you can't say that Alabamans as a people are unduly afraid of deep fryers. In that first week at the creek, the cafeteria served fried chicken, chicken fried steak, and fried okra, which marked my first foray into the delicacy that is the fried vegetable. I half expected them to fry the iceberg lettuce. But nothing matched the Bufrido, a dish created by Maureen, the amazingly and understandably obese Culver Creek cook. A deep-fried bean burrito, the Bufrido proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that frying always improves a food. Sitting with the colonel and five guys I didn't know at a circular table in the cafeteria that afternoon, I sank my teeth into the crunchy shell of my first Bufrido and experienced a culinary orgasm. My mom cooked okay, but I immediately wanted to bring Maureen home with me over Thanksgiving. The colonel introduced me, as Pudge, to the guys at the wobbly wooden table, but I only registered the name Takumi, whom Alaska had mentioned yesterday. A thin Japanese guy, only a few inches taller than the colonel, Takumi talked with his mouth full as I chewed slowly, savoring the beany crunch.
"God," Takumi said to me, "there's nothing like watching a man eat his first Bufrido."
I didn't say much, partly because no one asked me any questions, and partly because I just wanted to eat as much as I could. But Takumi felt no such modesty. He could and did eat and chew and swallow while talking. The lunch discussion centered on the girl who was supposed to have been Alaska's roommate, Mariah, and her boyfriend, Paul, who had been a weekday warrior. They'd gotten kicked out in the last weeks of the previous school year, I learned, for what the colonel called the trifecta. They were caught committing three of Culver Creek's expellable offenses at once,
lying naked in bed together, genital contact being offense number one, already drunk, number two. They were smoking a joint, number three, when the Eagle burst in on them. Rumors had it that someone had ratted them out, and Takumi seemed intent on finding out who. Intent enough, anyway, to shout about it with his mouth jam-packed with Bufrido.
Paul was an asshole, the colonel said. I wouldn't have ratted on them, but anyone who shacks up with a Jaguar-driving weekday warrior like Paul deserves what she gets.
Dude, Takumi responded, your girlfriend, and then he swallowed a bite of food, is a weekday warrior.
True, the colonel laughed. Much to my chagrin, that is an incontestable fact, but she is not as big an asshole as Paul.
Not quite,
Takumi smirked. The colonel laughed again, and I wondered why he wouldn't stand up for his girlfriend. I wouldn't have cared if my girlfriend was a Jaguar-driving cyclops with a beard. I'd have been grateful just to have someone to make out with.
That evening, when the colonel dropped by room 43 to pick up the cigarettes, he seemed to have forgotten that they were technically mine. I didn't really care when he didn't invite me out with him. In public school, I'd known plenty of people who made it a habit to hate this kind of person or that kind. The geeks hated the preps, etc., and it always seemed like a big waste of time to me. The colonel didn't tell me where he'd spent the afternoon or where he was going to spend the evening, but he closed the door behind him when he left, so I guessed I wasn't welcome. Just as well. I spent the night surfing the web, no porn, I swear, and reading The Final Days, a book about Richard Nixon and Watergate. For dinner, I microwaved a refrigerated Bufrido the colonel had snuck out of the cafeteria. It reminded me of nights in Florida, except with better food and no air conditioning. Lying in bed and reading felt pleasantly familiar. I decided to heed what I'm sure would have been my mother's advice and get a good night's sleep before my first day of classes. French 2 started at 8:10, and figuring it couldn't take more than 8 minutes to put on some clothes and walk to the classrooms, I set my alarm for 8:02. I took a shower and then lay in bed waiting for sleep to save me from the heat. Around 11 o'clock, I realized that the tiny fan clipped to my bunk might make more of a difference if I took off my shirt, and I finally fell asleep on top of the sheets wearing just boxers. A decision I found myself regretting some hours later when I awoke to two sweaty, meaty hands shaking the holy hell out of me. I woke up completely and instantly, sitting up straight in bed, terrified, and I couldn't understand the voices for some reason. Couldn't understand why there were any voices at all, and what the hell time was it anyway? And finally, my head cleared enough to hear,
come on, kid, don't make us kick your ass, just get up.
And then from the top bunk I heard,
Christ, Pudge, just get up.
So I got up and saw for the first time three shadowy figures. Two of them grabbed me, one with a hand on each of my upper arms, and walked me out of the room. On the way out, the colonel mumbled,
have a good time. Go easy on him, Kevin.
They led me, almost at a jog, behind my dorm building and then across the soccer field. The ground was grassy but gravelly, too, and I wondered why no one had shown the common courtesy to tell me to put on shoes. And why was I out there in my underwear, chicken legs exposed to the world? 1,000 humiliations crossed my mind. There's the new junior, Miles Halter, handcuffed to the soccer goal, wearing only his boxers. I imagined them taking me into the woods, where we now seemed headed, and beating the shit out of me, so that I looked great for my first day of school. And the whole time, I just stared at my feet, because I didn't want to look at them, and I didn't want to fall, so I watched my steps, trying to avoid the bigger rocks. I felt the fight-or-flight reflex swell up in me over and over again, but I knew that neither fight nor flight had ever worked for me before. They took me a roundabout way to the fake beach, and then I knew what would happen. A good old-fashioned dunking in the lake, and I calmed down. I could handle that. When we reached the beach, they told me to put my arms at my sides, and the beefiest guy grabbed two rolls of duct tape from the sand. With my arms flat against my sides like a soldier at attention, they mummified me from my shoulders to my wrists. Then they threw me to the ground, the sand from the fake beach cushioning the landing, but I still hit my head. Two of them pulled my legs together, while the other one, Kevin, I'd figured out,
put his angular, strong-jawed face up so close to mine that the gel-soaked spikes of hair pointing out from his forehead poked at my face and told me, "This is for the colonel. You shouldn't hang out with that asshole." They taped my legs together from ankles to thighs. I looked like a silver mummy. I said, "Please, guys, don't," just before they taped my mouth shut. Then they picked me up and hurled me into the water. Sinking. Sinking, but instead of feeling panic or anything else, I realized that, "Please, guys, don't," were terrible last words. But then, the great miracle of the human species, our buoyancy, came through. And as I felt myself floating toward the surface, I twisted and turned as best I could so that the warm night air hit my nose first and I breathed. I wasn't dead, and I wasn't going to die. Well, I thought, that wasn't so bad. But there was still the small matter of getting to shore before the sun rose. First, to determine my position vis-a-vis the shoreline. If I tilted my head too much, I felt my whole body start to roll, and on the long list of unpleasant ways to die, face down in soaking wet white boxers is pretty high up there. So instead, I rolled my eyes and craned my neck back, my eyes almost underwater, until I saw that the shore, not 10 feet away, was directly behind my head. I began to swim, an armless silver mermaid, using only my hips to generate motion, until finally my ass scraped against the lake's mucky bottom. I turned then and used my hips and waist to roll 3 times until I came ashore near a ratty green towel. They'd left me a towel. How thoughtful. The water had seeped under the duct tape and loosened the adhesive's grip on my skin, but the tape was wrapped around me 3 layers deep in places, which necessitated wiggling like a fish out of water. Finally, it loosened enough for me to slip my left hand up and out against my chest and rip the tape off. I wrapped myself in the sandy towel. I didn't want to go back to my room and see Chip, because I had no idea what Kevin had meant. Maybe if I went back to the room, they'd be waiting for me, and they'd get me for real. Maybe I needed to show them. Okay, got your message. He's just my roommate, not my friend. And anyway, I didn't feel terribly friendly toward the colonel. "Have a good time," he'd said. Yeah, I thought. I had a ball. So I went to Alaska's room. I didn't know what time it was, but I could see a faint light underneath her door. I knocked softly. "Yeah," she said, and I came in, wet and sandy and wearing only a towel and soaking boxers. This was not, obviously, how you want the world's hottest girl to see you, but I figured she could explain to me what had just happened. She put down a book and got out of bed with a sheet wrapped around her shoulders. For a moment, she looked concerned. She looked like the girl I met yesterday, the girl who said I was cute and who bubbled over with energy and silliness and intelligence. And then she laughed. "Guess you went for a swim, huh?" And she said it with such casual malice that I felt that everyone had known, and I wondered why the whole damn school agreed in advance to possibly drown Miles Halter. But Alaska liked the colonel, and in the confusion of the moment, I just looked at her blankly, unsure even of what to ask. "Give me a break," she said. "Come on, you know what? There are people with real problems. I've got real problems. Mommy ain't here, so buck up, big guy." I left without saying a word to her and went to my room, slamming the door behind me, waking the colonel and stomping into the bathroom. I got in the shower to wash the algae and the lake off me, but the ridiculous faucet of a shower had failed spectacularly. And how could Alaska and Kevin and those other guys already dislike me? After I finished the shower, I dried off and went into the room to find some clothes.
"So," he said, "what took you so long? Got lost on your way home?"
"They said it was because of you," I said, and my voice betrayed a hint of annoyance. "They said I shouldn't hang out with you."
"What?" "No, it happens to everybody," the colonel said. "It happened to me. They throw you in the lake. You swim out, you walk home."
"I couldn't just swim out," I said softly, pulling on a pair of jean shorts beneath my towel. "They duct-taped me. I couldn't even move, really."
"Wait, wait," he said, and hopped out of his bunk, staring at me through the darkness. "They taped you? How?"
And I showed him.
I stood like a mummy with my feet together and my hands at my sides and showed him how they'd wrapped me up. And then I plopped down onto the couch.
Christ, you could have drowned. They're just supposed to throw you in the water in your underwear and run, he shouted. What the hell were they thinking? Who was it? Kevin Richmond and who else? Do you remember their faces?
Yeah, I think.
Why the hell would they do that? He wondered.
Did you do something to them? I asked.
No, but I'm sure as shit gonna do something to them now. We'll get them.
It wasn't a big deal. I got out fine.
You could have died.
And I could have, I suppose, but I didn't. Well, maybe I should just go to the Eagle tomorrow and tell him, I said.
Absolutely not, he answered.
He walked over to his crumpled shorts lying on the floor and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. He lit two and handed one to me. I smoked the whole goddamn thing.
You're not, he continued, because that's not how shit gets dealt with here. And besides, you really don't want to get a reputation for ratting. But we will deal with those bastards, Pudge. I promise you, they will regret messing with one of my friends.
And if the colonel thought that calling me his friend would make me stand by him, well, he was right. Alaska was kind of mean to me tonight, I said. I leaned over, opened an empty desk drawer, and used it as a makeshift ashtray.
Like I said, she's moody.
I went to bed wearing a t-shirt, shorts, and socks. No matter how miserably hot it got, I resolved, I would sleep in my clothes every night at the creek, feeling, probably for the first time in my life, the fear and excitement of living in a place where you never know what's going to happen, or when. 126 days before.
Well, now it's war, the colonel shouted the next morning.
I rolled over and looked at the clock. 7:52. My first Culver Creek class, French, started in 18 minutes. I blinked a couple times and looked up at the colonel, who was standing between the couch and the coffee table, holding his well-worn, once white, tennis shoes by the laces. For a long time, he stared at me, and I stared at him. And then, almost in slow motion, a grin crept across the colonel's face.
I've got to hand it to them, he said finally. That was pretty clever.
What? I asked.
Last night, before they woke you up, I guess, they pissed in my shoes.
Are you sure? I said, trying not to laugh.
Do you care to smell? He asked, holding the shoes toward me. Because I went ahead and smelled them, and yes, I am sure. If there's one thing I know, it's when I've just stepped in another man's piss. It's like my mom always says.
You think you's a walkin' on water, but it turns out you just got piss in your shoes.
Point those guys out to me if you see them today, he added, because we need to figure out why they're so, pissed at me. And then we need to go ahead and start thinking about how we're going to ruin their miserable little lives.
When I received the Culver Creek handbook over the summer and noticed happily that the dress code section contained only two words, casual modesty, it never occurred to me that girls would show up for class half asleep in cotton pajama shorts, t-shirts, and flip-flops. Modest, I guess, and casual. And there was something about girls wearing pajamas, even if modest, which might have made French at 8:10 in the morning bearable if I'd had any idea what Madame O'Malley was talking about. Como dis-tu, oh my God, I don't know nearly enough French to pass French 2 en français? My French 1 class back in Florida did not prepare me for Madame O'Malley, who skipped the how was your summer pleasantries and dove directly into something called the passé composé, which is apparently a verb tense. Alaska sat directly across from me in the circle of desks, but she didn't look at me once the entire class, even though I could notice little but her. Maybe she could be mean, but the way she talked that first night about getting out of a labyrinth so smart, and the way her mouth curled up on the right side all the time, like she was preparing to smirk, like she'd mastered the right half of the Mona Lisa's inimitable smile. From my room, the student population seemed manageable, but it overwhelmed me in the classroom area, which was a single long building just beyond the dorm circle.
The building was split into 14 rooms facing out toward the lake. Kids crammed the narrow sidewalks in front of the classrooms, and even though finding my classes wasn't hard, even with my poor sense of direction I could get from French in room 3 to pre-calc in room 12, I felt unsettled all day. I didn't know anyone and couldn't even figure out whom I should be trying to know, and the classes were hard, even on the first day. My dad had told me I'd have to study, and now I believed him. The teachers were serious and smart, and a lot of them went by doctor. And so, when the time came for my last class before lunch, World Religions, I felt tremendous relief. A vestige from when Culver Creek was a Christian boys' school, I figured the World Religions class, required of every junior and senior, might be an easy A. It was my only class all day where the desks weren't arranged either in a square or a circle, so not wanting to seem eager, I sat down in the third row at 11:03. I was 7 minutes early, partly because I liked to be punctual, and partly because I didn't have anyone to chat with out in the halls. Shortly thereafter, the colonel came in with Takumi, and they sat down on opposite sides of me.
"I heard about last night," Takumi said. "Alaska's pissed."
"That's weird, since she was such a bitch last night," I blurted out. Takumi just shook his head.
"Yeah, well, she didn't know the whole story. And people are moody, dude. You gotta get used to living with people. You could have worse friends than..."
The colonel cut him off. "Enough with the psychobabble, MC Dr. Phil. Let's talk counterinsurgency." People were starting to file into class, so the colonel leaned in toward me and whispered, "If any of them are in this class, let me know, okay? Just put X's where they're sitting." And he ripped a sheet of paper out of his notebook and drew a square for each desk. As people filed in, I saw one of them, the tall one with immaculately spiky hair, Kevin. Kevin stared down the colonel as he walked past, but in trying to stare, he forgot to watch his step and bumped his thigh against a desk. The colonel laughed. One of the other guys, the one who was either a little fat or worked out too much, came in behind Kevin, sporting pleated khaki pants and a short-sleeved black polo shirt. As they sat down, I crossed through the appropriate squares on the colonel's diagram and handed it to him. Just then, the old man shuffled in. He breathed slowly and with great labor through his wide-open mouth. He took tiny steps toward the lectern, his heels not moving much past his toes. The colonel nudged me and pointed casually to his notebook, which read, "The old man only has one lung," and I did not doubt it. His audible, almost desperate breaths reminded me of my grandfather when he was dying of lung cancer. Barrel-chested and ancient, the old man, it seemed to me, might die before he ever reached the podium.
"My name," he said, "is Dr. Hyde. I have a first name, of course. So far as you are concerned, it is Doctor. Your parents pay a great deal of money so that you can attend school here, and I expect that you will offer them some return on their investment by reading what I tell you to read when I tell you to read it, and consistently attending this class. And when you are here, you will listen to what I say."
Clearly not an easy A.
"This year we'll be studying 3 religious traditions, Islam, Christianity, and Buddhism. We'll tackle 3 more traditions next year. And in my classes, I will talk most of the time, and you will listen most of the time. Because you may be smart, but I've been smart longer. I'm sure some of you do not like lecture classes, but as you have probably noted, I'm not as young as I used to be. I would love to spend my remaining breath chatting with you about the finer points of Islamic history, but our time together is short. I must talk and you must listen, for we are engaged here in the most important pursuit in history, the search for meaning. What is the nature of being a person? What is the best way to go about being a person? How did we come to be, and what will become of us when we are no longer? In short, what are the rules of this game, and how might we best play it?
The nature of the labyrinth, I scribbled into my spiral notebook, and the way out of it. This teacher rocked. I hated discussion classes. I hated talking, and I hated listening to everyone else stumble on their words and try to phrase things in the vaguest possible ways so they wouldn't sound dumb. And I hated how it was all just a game of trying to figure out what the teacher wanted to hear and then saying it. I'm in class, so teach me. And teach me he did. In those 50 minutes, the old man made me take religion seriously. I'd never been religious, but he told us that religion is important whether or not we believed in one, in the same way that historical events are important whether or not you personally lived through them. And then he assigned us 50 pages of reading for the next day from a book called Religious Studies. That afternoon, I had 2 classes and 2 free periods. We had 9 50-minute class periods each day, which means that most everyone had 3 study periods, except for the colonel, who had an extra independent study math class on account of being an extra special genius. The colonel and I had biology together, where I pointed out the other guy who'd duct-taped me the night before. In the top corner of his notebook, the colonel wrote, "Longwell Chase, Senior W. Day Warrior, friends with Sarah. Weird." It took me a minute to remember who Sarah was, the colonel's girlfriend. I spent my free periods in my room trying to read about religion. I learned that myth doesn't mean a lie. It means a traditional story that tells you something about people and their worldview and what they hold sacred. Interesting. I also learned that after the events of the previous night, I was far too tired to care about myths or anything else, so I slept on top of the covers for most of the afternoon until I awoke to Alaska singing, "Wake up, little Pudgy," directly into my left ear canal. I held the religion book close up against my chest like a small paperback security blanket. "That was terrible," I said. "What do I need to do to ensure that never happens to me again?" "Nothing you can do," she said excitedly. "I'm unpredictable. God, don't you hate Dr. Hyde, don't you? He's so condescending." I sat up and said, "I think he's a genius," partly because I thought it was true and partly because I just felt like disagreeing with her. She sat down on the bed. "Do you always sleep in your clothes?" "Yep." "Funny," she said. "You weren't wearing much last night." I just glared at her. "Come on, Pudge, I'm teasing. You have to be tough here. I didn't know how bad it was, and I'm sorry, and they'll regret it, but you have to be tough." And then she left. That was all she had to say on the subject. She's cute, I thought, but you don't need to like a girl who treats you like you're 10. You've already got a mom. 122 days before. After my last class of my first week at Culver Creek, I entered room 43 to an unlikely sight. The diminutive and shirtless colonel hunched over an ironing board, attacking a pink button-down shirt. Sweat trickled down his forehead and chest as he ironed with great enthusiasm, his right arm pushing the iron across the length of the shirt with such vigor that his breathing nearly duplicated Dr. Hyde's. "I have a date," he explained. "This is an emergency." He paused to catch his breath. "Do you know how to iron?" I walked over to the pink shirt. It was wrinkled, like an old woman who'd spent her youth sunbathing. If only the colonel didn't ball up his every belonging and stuff it into random dresser drawers. "I think you just turn it on and press it against the shirt, right?" I said. "I don't know. I didn't even know we had an iron." "We don't. It's Takumi's. But Takumi doesn't know how to iron either. And when I asked Alaska, she started yelling, 'You're not going to impose the patriarchal paradigm on me.' Oh, God, I need to smoke. I need to smoke, but I can't reek when I see Sarah's parents. Okay, screw it. We're going to smoke in the bathroom with the shower on. The shower has steam. Steam gets rid of wrinkles, right?" "By the way," he said as I followed him into the bathroom, "if you want to smoke inside during the day, just turn on the shower. The smoke follows the steam up the vents." Though this made no scientific sense, it seemed to work. The shower's shortage of water pressure and low shower head made it all but useless for showering,
but it worked great as a smokescreen. Sadly, it made a poor iron. The colonel tried ironing the shirt once more.
I'm just going to push really hard and see if that helps.
And finally put it on wrinkled. He matched the shirt with a blue tie, decorated with horizontal lines of little pink flamingos.
The one thing my lousy father taught me, the colonel said as his hands nimbly threaded the tie into a perfect knot, was how to tie a tie. Which is odd, since I can't imagine when he ever had to wear one.
Just then, Sarah knocked on the door. I'd seen her once or twice before, but the colonel never introduced me to her, and didn't have a chance to that night.
"Oh, my God, can't you at least press your shirt?"
she asked, even though the colonel was standing in front of the ironing board.
"We're going out with my parents!"
Sarah looked awfully nice in her blue summer dress. Her long, pale blonde hair was pulled up into a twist, with a strand of hair falling down each side of her face. She looked like a movie star. A bitchy one.
Look, I did my best. We don't all have maids to do our ironing.
Chip, that chip on your shoulder makes you look even shorter.
Christ, can't we get out the door without fighting?
I'm just saying, it's the opera. It's a big deal to my parents. Whatever, let's go.
I felt like leaving, but it seemed stupid to hide in the bathroom, and Sarah was standing in the doorway, one hand cocked on her hip and the other fiddling with her car keys as if to say, "Let's go."
"I could wear a tuxedo and your parents would still hate me," he shouted.
"That's not my fault. You antagonize them."
She held up the car keys in front of him.
"Look, we're going now or we're not going."
"Fuck it. I'm not going anywhere with you," the colonel said.
"Fine. Have a great night."
Sarah slammed the door so hard that a sizable biography of Leo Tolstoy, last words, "The truth is, I care a great deal, what they," fell off my bookshelf and landed with a thud on our checkered floor, like an echo of the slamming door.
"Ah!"
he screamed. "So, that's Sarah," I said.
"Yes."
"She seems nice."
The colonel laughed, knelt down next to the mini-fridge, and pulled out a gallon of milk. He opened it, took a swig, winced, half-coughed, and sat down on the couch with the milk between his legs.
"Is it sour or something?"
"Oh, I should have mentioned that earlier. This isn't milk. It's 5 parts milk and 1 part vodka. I call it ambrosia, drink of the gods. You can barely smell the vodka in the milk, so the eagle can't catch me unless he actually takes a sip. The downside is that it tastes like sour milk and rubbing alcohol, but it's Friday night, Pudge, and my girlfriend is a bitch. Want some?"
"I think I'll pass."
Aside from a few sips of champagne on New Year's, under the watchful eye of my parents, I'd never really drunk any alcohol, and ambrosia didn't seem like the drink with which to start. Outside, I heard the payphone ring. Given the fact that 190 boarders shared 5 payphones, I was amazed at how infrequently it rang. We weren't supposed to have cell phones, but I'd noticed that some of the weekday warriors carried them surreptitiously. And most non-warriors called their parents, as I did, on a regular basis, so parents only called when their kids forgot.
"Are you going to get that?" the colonel asked me.
I didn't feel like being bossed around by him, but I also didn't feel like fighting. Through a buggy twilight, I walked to the payphone, which was drilled into the wall between rooms 44 and 45. On both sides of the phone, dozens of phone numbers and esoteric notes were written in pen and marker. 205-555-1584. Tommy to Airport 420. 773-573-6521. JG, cuffs? Calling the payphone required a great deal of patience. I picked up on about the 9th ring.
"Can you get Chip for me?" Sarah asked.
It sounded like she was on a cell phone.
"Yeah, hold on."
I turned, and he was already behind me, as if he knew it would be her. I handed him the receiver and walked back to the room. A minute later, 3 words made their way to our room through the thick, still air of Alabama at almost night.
"Screw you, too!" the colonel shouted.
Back in the room, he sat down with his ambrosia and told me, "She says I ratted out Paul and Mariah. That's what the warriors are saying, that I ratted them out, me.
That's why the piss in the shoes. That's why they're nearly killing you, because you live with me and they say I'm a rat.
I tried to remember who Paul and Mariah were. The names were familiar, but I'd heard so many names in the last week, and I couldn't match Paul and Mariah with faces. And then I remembered why. I'd never seen them. They got kicked out the year before, having committed the trifecta. "How long have you been dating her?" I asked.
9 months. We never got along. I mean, I didn't even briefly like her. Like my mom and my dad. My dad would get pissed, and then he would beat the shit out of my mom. And then my dad would be all nice, and they'd have like a honeymoon period. But with Sarah, there's never a honeymoon period.
God, how could she think I was a rat?
I know. Why don't we break up?
He ran a hand through his hair, clutching a fistful of it atop his head, and said,
I guess I stay with her because she stays with me. And that's not an easy thing to do. I'm a bad boyfriend. She's a bad girlfriend. We deserve each other.
But
I can't believe they think that, he said as he walked to the bookshelf and pulled down the almanac.
He took a long pull off his ambrosia.
Goddamn weekday warriors. It was probably one of them that ratted out Paul and Mariah and then blamed me to cover their tracks. Anyway, it's a good night for staying in. Staying in with Pudge and Ambrosia.
I still, I said, wanting to say that I didn't understand how you could kiss someone who believed you were a rat if being a rat was the worst thing in the world, but the colonel cut me off.
Not another word about it. You know what the capital of Sierra Leone is?
No.
Me neither, he said, but I intend to find out.
And with that, he stuck his nose in the almanac, and the conversation was over.
This is the end of disc number one. Please continue listening on disc number two.